Hello, my fans, friends. Welcome to the Rich Herring podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. Thanks to everyone who's come to see the Can I Have My Ball Back tour so far. It's been going really well. I've got a 4-star review in The Standard, 4-star review in The Telegraph, who once called me the worst comedy experience of the year, so that's a turnaround. People have been coming, people have really been enjoying it, and it's getting better and better. The only gigs this week are both in Pocklington, the town I was born in, near York. There's a couple of tickets left for the evening show and a few more tickets left for the matinee, I think about 4:30. But love to see you there, Yorkshire. Pop along. Check richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs to see if I'm coming near to you. There are tickets left for nearly every show in the tour. I think Norwich has sold out. And a couple of gigs in London could do with your support as well. Anyway, please listen to the podcast. Do spread the news about the podcast to your friends. Listen as much as you can. Numbers are slightly down, which may affect the future of this podcast. So just leave it playing, even if you're not in the room. Love you. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy whatever it is you're going to listen to.
Life is full of awesome what-ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, welcome to another book club. I'm delighted to be joined by Rebecca Ragg-Sykes, who's written a little while ago, actually, I've only just come across a fantastic book called Kindred, Neanderthal Life, Love, Death and Art. Hello, Rebecca. How are you doing?
Hello. I'm great. Thank you for having me.
It's my pleasure. So tell us a little bit about who you are, for anyone who's unaware of you as an academic.
I'm not quite sure I'm technically an academic now.
Oh, I think you are.
I have an honorary fellowship at the University of Liverpool, so I'm an archaeologist, and I'm part of the archaeology department there, but I'm actually sort of more like a writer and an author, although I still, you know, I work on archaeological material, but I don't excavate things right now.
Okay.
I'm out of the trench.
Which is probably quite good. I did a bit of archaeology many years ago when I was 18. I did two or three digs. So in fact one of them was Neolithic, I think it was, which I found very confusing at the time. which we'll get onto with your book, but how you
tell quite common with the Neolithic.
How you tell a piece of flint that's been worked from a piece of flint that isn't worked, which we will get onto because there's a lot about that in your book. So anyway, tell us about how, I know this book took you 8 years or something of work and research, and it's a very all-encompassing. I have to say it's a brilliant book. It's a reappraisal of what people would imagine Neanderthals are like. But why did you want to write this book, and how did this book come about, and what were you attempting to achieve?
It was 3 years of actual writing, but yes, sort of overall it represents a fair bit more in terms of study and assimilation of stuff. So yes, I do have an academic background. So my PhD was in the Neanderthals of Britain, the late Neanderthals of Britain. So for us, late is sort of 50,000 years ago.
Right.
So I'm a stone tool specialist in terms of my training in that way. But, you know, like a lot of people in science and research and academia, after your PhD, it's not always easy to just slide into a nice lectureship or professorship. It's a little bit harder than that these days. So I kind of was working on various projects, and then I was very lucky and got a postdoctoral fellowship in France. So I was there for a few years. But when that finished, which was like the end of 2015, I applied for more things and I didn't get any future like funding or more grants and things, but I had already had contact with a publisher via social media on Twitter. Everything happens on Twitter. And they were interested in me writing actually about humanity and birds in prehistory because I quite like bird watching. But for various reasons that book didn't happen. But they also wanted me to write about Neanderthals because that's actually, you know, my area of expertise archaeologically. So when my postdoc finished, I stayed in France for a little bit and I just started writing the book, although I was really intimidated to do that because it's a very big topic and weirdly it being closer to my academic sort of area of knowledge, it felt harder and scarier to write it. I'm not quite sure why. Maybe because I was worried what my colleagues might think. And also because I knew that this was actually going to be what I was hoping it to be, a book that was a little bit different about Neanderthals and was kind of focused very much on what we can say archaeologically, but also, you know, use the science as a jumping off point to connect people actually with that deep past and do that with a little bit of imagination.
Yeah, it's an amazing book in what it brings together, because it is such a, you know, spiraling huge subject itself, but you also talk about the history of you know, our discovery of Neanderthals and where it made right and wrong turns there, as well as sort of the sort of technical aspects of the archaeology. Because I sort of was under the impression we didn't really know all that much about Neanderthals, but this book it's sort of incredible the depth it can go to. But before we get into that, do you want to tell us a little bit about how long we've known there are Neanderthals and how we sort of recognize them as a different species of hominid?
Yeah, I mean, I think this actually connects really well to what you just said. You know, the reason why I can write a gigantic book about Neanderthals and kind of talk about all these different aspects of their lives, you know, from birth to death and all different facets of their existence, is because we have known about Neanderthals for quite a while, compared to other hominin species, so sort of extinct human relations. Neanderthals are the first of those hominin species that we actually realized existed. And this happened in the middle of the 19th century, just as archaeology itself was kind of beginning to, you know, become a discipline rather than just a hobby for rich people. You know, in that way, Neanderthals have been there from the emergence of prehistory as a science itself. So we have had a very long time to get to know them. But also there's a huge amount of material that we have from Neanderthals. So obviously you have to begin with a first find. And it took a little while in the 19th century for discoveries to sort of mount up. But, you know, today we've got thousands of pieces of bone and probably representing a couple of hundred individual Neanderthals at least. You know, so those are individuals we can know things about. But then we got literally millions of the objects that they made, stone tools. But yeah, like if you go back to the 19th century, the arrival of Neanderthals was, you know, I said it's a little bit like buses. You know, we didn't really know much about prehistory for centuries. You know, it was the odd fossil find, but people didn't really know what these weird things were. You've got Mary Anning in the early 19th century finding what, you know, they were calling sea lizards and things like this, you know, which were actually, you know, marine reptiles, ichthyosaurs, plesiosaurs and things like that. But it wasn't long after that the first hominin discoveries began, but we don't really have a clear picture of the understanding at that time because the people themselves didn't really know what they were finding.
Sure.
So we've got two discoveries of Neanderthals in the early decades of the 19th century, but neither of those were recognised as anything particularly out of the ordinary. And then it took until 1856 when we have the finding from the Neanderthal, so the Neander Valley in Germany, which gives us that species name. And that was the one where it was realised that this was something out of the ordinary and a different kind of human. So there's kind of nothing in our understanding of deep prehistory for so long. And then three of these come along at once in, you know, a few decades in the Victorian times.
I quite like the bit early in the book where you discuss the obviously they're named after the Neander Valley, but the Neander Valley is named after a guy, right? So it's so it's named after a person, which is, you know, it's nice to get a valley named after you, but then accidentally Neander ends up with this species of humanity named after him, which might not be seen as the greatest compliment, but maybe it is. But it is a very interesting story.
Yeah, I mean, it's a weird... It's one of those weird sort of serendipitous moments in the history of science, you know, because, I mean, a lot of how we know what we know about the world comes from, you know, chance and serendipity and things like this. But in this case, it's especially satisfying because, so the Neanderthal, Thal being German for valley, was named after a composer from the 1600s called Joachim Neander. And he wrote a lot of religious music and was very celebrated. And that's kind of nice in itself. But the funny bit is the fact that his name, Neander, was a sort of a classicization in this fashion of the time to kind of change your name to sound a bit more classical. And the original name was Neumann. But both of those mean new man.
Yeah.
So the very first place that we recognised that there had been other forms of humanity on the Earth is from the Valley of the New Man. Yeah. So you couldn't get a more perfect kind of place. You know, I don't think that happens very often.
It's very good. And also just, you know, obviously he doesn't know. But it's a weird thing to think that in 400 or 500 years' time you go, oh yeah, no, there'll be a species of man named after you, incidentally, but named after a place.
It would have blown his mind, I'm sure. I hope
he'd have been really annoyed. I'm not sure how you'd feel about it. It's interesting. The book, as well as being about Neanderthals, which is incredibly interesting, but it's sort of about the triumph of archaeology, because it's, even to me, and I'm interested in archaeology, and I haven't kept up with things quite as much, but the technicality of what you can discover from such tiny and weird things now, and you know, and microanalysis of soil. I mean, there's stuff you talk about, the smoke coming from fires, you know, leaving traces on cave walls and that kind of thing, that gives us stuff that we can, you know, as an archaeologist, I think most archaeologists are out there obviously trying to find the Holy Grail. That's literally the Holy Grail of archaeology. But the archaeology has this, you know, sweeping sort of technical side where you're able to find out so much just from the soil, the analysis of teeth, which I was talking to Brenna Hassett about, which was very interesting. But do you want to tell us a bit about the archaeological techniques that allow us to know so much about the Neanderthals?
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing, you know, like Indiana Jones, he just basically goes through and trashes all the good stuff. You know, we want the soil samples. We don't want the gold. But, you know, I mean, yeah, that's kind of why, you know, why it is possible to discuss really quite intimate aspects of Neanderthals' lives. You know, what did they eat? Because we can find tiny little fragments of starches in the grot that sort of accumulates on their teeth, and which our dental hygienists get rid of. So future archaeologists will be upset about that. But you know, things like that. It's all come from a revolution in archaeological science, really, over the past 40 to 50 years. There is just a bewildering array, actually, of different methods for squeezing out every kind of data that you can imagine from the stuff that we find. So, you know, traditionally, people were basically digging up from Neanderthal sites. You would get bones or stones. That was kind of it. You might be really lucky and get a preserved bit of wood. But now what we've realized is that there is a ton of information within material that was being thrown out, so sediments, but also on the objects that we were always finding. So on stone tools, for example, you know, if Brenna's talked about the teeth, I won't go into the detail with that. People will have to listen to her episode. But yeah, I mean, there's so much you can do with teeth. It's mad. But also with stone tools. So, you know, if you go back to, I don't know, like the 1930s, 1940s, what people really interested in with stone tools then was kind of just the shape of them. And there was an attempt to sort of arrange all the different sort of objects that we find from archaeological sites and classify that in order to compare different layers within sites and to compare sites themselves for evidence of, you know, what a Neanderthal is doing. How do we understand why there are different types of tools in their sites? But that's like a really basic thing. It's basically like the morphometrics of those objects, but in a really sort of limited way that they were studied. Whereas today, kind of two things happened. One is that we understand that rather than the shape of the tools, the way that they were made is actually really informative about how Neanderthals thought. But to understand how Neanderthal technology of what we call lithics, which is just stone tools, basically stone artifacts, lithic technology, to know that you need to have the full array of material that's left behind, as well as the actual tools that are being used, because you can essentially fit it all back together. And that's what people for decades were throwing out from their sites. They were only keeping the nice bits, like, oh, a lovely scraper, we'll keep that. but we get rid of all the little flakes that were, you know, made during that manufacturing process, and that people assumed were just waste. Now we understand that, A, you can refit stuff back together and literally watch the sequence of decisions that individual Neanderthals made as they tackled one block of stone. And I should say, they had many different ways of doing this. They were exceptional artisans with rock. They understood all different kinds of stone, ways to manipulate it. They had very clear end products in mind. They made more than one kind of tool. So we can see them making those decisions, making choices. You know, if you have a lump of rock with a you know, a flaw in it, a crack, as they meet that while they're taking that stone apart, what do they do? You know, how do they manage that? So we can see all of this just by refitting these things. And so that forces that realization means that we kind of do slow archaeology today. You know, we don't sort of just go in and hammer out all the stuff and empty sites and chuck things. It's very meticulous. So excavation of sites now takes a long time, but what we can get out of it is very good. So you've got the refitting, but then also we've realized that you can do a lot with individual objects. So for example, one of the things that has changed in our understanding is that we can see individual objects were being resharpened. So they didn't just kind of make a tool, use it and chuck it. Sometimes they did, actually. They had some disposable tech methods that they were quite consciously using in a disposable way. But in other times and places, it made sense for them to keep their tools, and they resharpen those. And you can actually see the sequences of that happening. But we can also then look for distinctive, like, polishing that you get accumulating on the surface of a stone tool based on what you've used it to cut or chop or scrape. So we can start to see the individual histories of tools as they are used for different purposes and then resharpened and then used again. Sometimes we can get actual residues of materials themselves that they were using to process. So again, starches, things like this. So there's all these different aspects of what we can do just with stone tools now.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it just seems impossible. I mean, impossibly boring for the people doing it. I mean, quite impossibly fastidious, you know, and working out how long a family might have stayed in a particular cave based on the soot residue. Is that what we're talking about, the soot residue on the...
Yeah,
it's so a bit more complicated than that.
Well, no, I mean, this is another sort of recent method. You know, there's all sorts of things. You know, we've got various different archaeological science methods. We can look at chemicals in bones and teeth. We can obviously do paleogenomics, a huge area of research. But another one that's just recently been developed is a realization that in some places inside caves where you have an accumulation of calcite deposits that naturally form on the walls of the cave over time, you know, that's what makes stalagmites or stalactites, that same process of deposition. In some sites, it's been demonstrated that as people are living in those places and they make a fire and some of the fire is billowing around inside the chamber, it leaves a very thin, tiny layer of soot on the surface of these calcite deposits, which, and then when the people leave and nobody's in the cave, the calcite continues forming, but there's no soot there. And so what you end up with is kind of like an archive of the presence of people and their absence. And if you were, if you've kind of, maybe some people listening to this remember, you know, the wonder that is Time Team, and sometimes they were talking about, you know it, don't you?
I do.
Dendrochronology. It's a similar thing with tree rings. If you want to find out how old something is with tree rings, you take sections and you kind of have to fit them together. It's like cross-referencing. They've done a similar thing with these soot residues. They can look a bit like barcodes. You know, you get a sequence of all these layers building up. And if you cross-reference those and try and match them, that allows you to essentially make an argument for how many occupations there are within each individual layer. Which sounds really like a very nitpicking thing to care about, but it is really important for us as archaeologists, because when you dig very, very ancient sites, when we're talking about with Neanderthals, you might have a layer. So one layer that is distinctive because the colour of the sediment is different from the one above and below. But how much time is represented by that layer? That's a really important question for us, because it means, you know, there's a temporal element to the artifacts in that layer. We need to know that, you know, is it 10 years of occupations, or are you looking at 1,000 years of time? And if that's the case, that's going to change how we interpret the material we find in that layer. And so this method of, I think it's called fulgurochronology, soot chronology, allows us to get a handle in some places on how many times people actually lived there, and therefore, you know, how that relates to how many stone tools we find within that layer and the character of them and things like this. So that kind of thing. Yeah, I mean, you know, you say all of this kind of has boring elements to it. And I do agree with you, because it's a bit like all science, you know, there are long periods where it's quite dull, even while digging, you know, you kind of have to go in like a Zen mode in your brain and just partially tune your mind out while you're working, but not, you know, so you don't pay attention to what you're doing, but you know, you don't get excited by every fragment of soil that you dig up. And it's like that with all the kind of work we do when we are dealing with really what is the way we excavate and analyze today. We have very, very large databases of objects to deal with. So you have to, you know, you excavate your layer, maybe a layer, I don't know, 20 centimeters thick. If you have a really rich Neanderthal site, that one layer of 20 centimeters thick from, I don't know, a rock shelter, you might be looking at 40,000 fragments of bone, 20,000 stone objects. And all of those have to be individually catalogued, put into a database, measured or studied in some way. And then, you know, we have to pull out of that the stuff we really want to know, which is how were Neanderthals living? What were their lives like? So there is a lot of kind of keyboard bashing and, you know, stuff like this that goes on in terms of wrangling all of that information. But it's worth it for what we can actually say about past lives.
Yeah. Well, given that most of the stuff that we're talking about has disintegrated or more or less disappeared, you know, this book really gives, you know, you extrapolate that information logically and academically but do create a vivid understanding of what the world might have been like, very possibly was like. I mean, you know, the cover claims that it's going to be the end of life, love, death, and art, which is hard to believe given what you're talking about, that some soil or some chips of Flint can tell you about how Neanderthals loved each other. But do you want to tell us about your favorite examples of what we know about? I mean, I'm always interested in sex, so we know that Neanderthals and Homo sapiens at some point got together, because there's bits of Neanderthal inside most of us, so we know that there. But what do we know about Neanderthal love, let's say? What's your favorite thing from that?
Well, I mean, there's so much that you can kind of discuss in terms of the details of how they lived. You know, like, there's the economic stuff, there's the hunting and how they made tools and things like this. But as you say, you know, to a large extent, people want to know, what did it feel like to be a Neanderthal?
Yeah.
And first of all, I mean, I think we should definitely make it clear that Neanderthals are extremely closely related to us. They are our closest known relative. So, like, out of all the animals and creatures alive today, it's chimpanzees and bonobos that are our closest relations. Yeah. But Neanderthals are way, way closer to us than that. You know, our last common ancestor with chimpanzees is about 5 to 7 million years ago. With Neanderthals, it's somewhere around maybe 600,000 years ago. So much, much, much more recent. Hmm. If you look at their bodies, so much about their bodies is really, really similar to us. There are differences all over their skeletons, for sure, but compared to, you know, other primates, other apes even, they clearly are a kind of human. So just on that basis, and the fact that they had very large brains like us, clearly extremely cognitively complex beings, we should expect them to have had really rich emotional lives. You know, I do talk about primates regularly in the book, because they offer us such a good lesson in the fact that, yeah, cognition and intelligence and smartness is important, but actually what drives chimpanzees' lives is emotion. You know, they are completely driven by that. And if we think about ourselves, actually, we are as well. You know, we might think we're very rational and we do make some rational decisions, but underlying all that is emotion. So Neanderthals, I am absolutely sure, felt the emotion of love. I don't think that anybody would actually be able to dispute that. You know, they would have felt immensely strong emotional attachments to the close relations that they had, just as we do and just as we can see in lots of animals. But, you know, what are the expressions of that that we can see archaeologically? I think one of the areas that has kind of had a renaissance, actually, in how we think about this is the question of burial. What do Neanderthals do with the dead? And this is probably one of the bits of archaeology that you can't really call boring, because there's always kind of, you know, new finds that come up, but it's also extremely challenging to interpret those. And for a long time, in fact, some of the earliest finds of Neanderthal skeletons, so from sort of about 1908, was a rather complete skeleton from France called the Old Man of La Chapelle-aux-Saints. And that was interpreted from the beginning as a probable burial. So the early prehistorians studying Neanderthals had the assumption that they would have buried their dead, which I find quite interesting. But then over later decades, quite rightly, researchers became more sceptical and sort of demanded a bit more evidence than just finding a whole body. And so if you come forward to where we are today, there's been a really interesting trend of some early discoveries of Neanderthal bodies. As I said at the beginning, you know, we have a lot of different remains of Neanderthals, and some that were claimed as burials are less clear. You know, they could just be individuals that kind of got lost. For example, there's one case where from France, where we might be looking at an individual that just fell into a cave system through the roof. With, you know, you see animals, that happens to animals as well, so it's a pretty nasty end. But with the case at La Chapelle-Ausson, researchers went back to that site and have tried to reassess that. You know, you've got the skeleton of an old man, which was kind of half lying on his side, in what was described at the time as a pit. And the guys digging this, they were actually three brothers priests, which is a whole other interesting angle to this, that you've got these priests in the early 20th century really into human evolution. but they described this as a big pit. So what researchers did was they literally went back to the cave, dug out all the trash that was covering the original layer, and they did rediscover the pit. And they did their best to kind of work out, is it a natural pit or is it not? And they couldn't really certainly do that based on the geology. They said they probably don't think it's a natural cavity, and it probably was, you know, at the least sort of enlarged and scraped out by Neanderthals. But what they were able to show there was that the history of what happened to that Neanderthal skeleton when it was in the site has to be different to all the animal bones there, and also some other bits of other Neanderthals that the original excavators hadn't noticed because they were digging, you know, not especially carefully compared to our standards, and, you know, by oil lamps and things like this. So those remains, the animals and the other Neanderthal bits, are a different condition to the skeleton. So something happened to that skeleton that meant that it stayed preserved in this pit, not pit feature. So that's kind of the best you can do with old excavations. Yeah. What you need is nice new excavations that are dug using all the methods that we have at our disposal today, and our understanding that you have to dig extremely carefully, and, you know, that stories can be held within tiny layers of sediment and things. And we do have that. So there's a site that's being worked on at the moment, extremely exciting site in Kurdistan, part of Iraq. And that's called Shanidar Cave. Maybe some listeners might remember a series of books by Jean Owl from the 1980s and 90s. They were novels set, you know, 30,000 years ago, talking about humans and Neanderthals meeting and all this. One of the characters from that is based on one of the skeletons from Shanidar, Kreb. He was like a shaman. You know, that's that story. But the real Shanidar Cave is fascinating. So this was dug in the 60s. The remains of about nine different Neanderthals were found. Again, they were claimed to be burials. And on the balance of evidence, some of those definitely are fairly described as probable burials today. But a new team has gone back to Shanidar in the last few years, and they have found a new individual there. And most intriguingly, it's right underneath the remains of at least four others. In a really, you know, quite sort of thin depth of sediment, there's all these different individuals on top of each other. One of them that was found in the 60s was laying on his side, and was quite impressive. And there was pollen found around this individual, and it was claimed maybe it's burial with flowers, perhaps. But again, that was like, maybe it is, maybe it isn't. But the more recent individual, who they've called Shanidar Z, to differentiate it from the others who had numbers, this one, again, is lying on its side. It's only the upper half of the body. And in this case, by applying all these more modern methods and looking very carefully at the sediment, the research team believes that this is an individual that was put in maybe what was a natural sort of erosion channel, but that was enlarged, and they have found tiny little macro remains of plants in there. So this is still ongoing work. It's still to be published in more detail, but this is the best example that we have from any modern site, which does seem to support the idea that Neanderthals, in sometimes in places, were depositing the bodies of individuals who had died in a particular way, and potentially also including materials with them, so perhaps plants. So, you know, that's really, really quite intriguing. And in terms of the question of love, you know, why do you do that? The thing about burials is that they tell you stuff about the individual themselves. You can look at their skeleton, but what happens to the body is telling you about everybody who's still alive in that group and why they do that. So why you would choose to carefully position the body of an individual Neanderthal after they're dead, that is instantly giving us something about social sort of context, a social understanding of mortality, basically. What does that actually mean for these individuals? And again, you know, if you go back to chimpanzees and bonobos as a basic, as a baseline, you could say, we know that death is really, really traumatic for them. They may not understand it necessarily in the way that we understand it, but the passing of an individual within that group is a huge event for them and affects them enormously emotionally. But really intriguingly, they are really focused on the bodies. They don't just walk off. The focus of the emotion and the processing of what, which I think we can call grief, is always focused on the bodies. And they sometimes actually, especially with mothers and very young infants that die, they will carry them around for a while. So for me, I think it makes total sense that another kind of human who is, you know, has a brain as complicated in many ways as ours, perhaps not all, but in many ways, who would have obviously had emotionally rich lives, that there would be a focus on the body when a death happens. I think it makes complete sense. But that doesn't mean they're always buried, because something else that's come out is that maybe sometimes they also are taking bodies apart, by which I mean butchering.
Yeah.
And maybe eating.
Yeah. Which is, you know, it's a way of showing love, isn't it?
Well, you know what? I did put this in the book because people react really badly to this whole thing about cannibalism. Oh my God, Neanderthals, you know, brutes eating each other. But there is a very distinct thread of this in our own culture as well. It's just unrecognised. You know, you've got the whole Catholic mass that the body of Christ is eaten, and that is believed, you know, as a literal thing. It's not a metaphor. And then you've also got this weird stuff that people who are drawn to eat the ashes of their loved ones. There's something about wanting to keep part of the body and merge it with yourself. So I don't know. I mean, I'm sure they're not thinking in those specific terms, but there is something recognizable there.
Yeah.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love. And be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit eBay.com for terms.
Well, it is interesting. Let's talk briefly about the interbreeding. So they're pretty similar to human beings, and they're similar enough that it was possible to have sex and to have progeny from that sex. So that makes us, you know, much closer than, you know, if I went out and had sex with a chimp, I could try as hard as I want, but I'm not going to have a half chimp, half human baby. And I've tried.
No.
But
I hope not.
But I'm joking. Neanderthals and humans were breeding. I think you say it was not a regular thing from the evidence. But do you have any idea who was instigating the sexual contact and whether it would have been something approved of by either group?
Yeah, I mean, this is such a tricky thing. And, you know, paleogenomics has been absolutely crucial to moving us along in understanding the whole question of, did we meet Neanderthals? The answer, yes, we did. And it is the genetics that has proven that, because it was very, very difficult to prove that archaeologically. So we know that Neanderthals and ourselves, Homo sapiens, did meet. And the picture now is really looking quite complicated. We're getting the impression that there was interbreeding over quite a long time period. So, you know, maybe before 250,000 years ago. So I'll just actually give a little bit of chronology because it's sort of helpful, this. So Neanderthals emerge within Eurasia, Western Eurasia, around about sort of 400 to 350,000 years ago. And we are busy emerging within Africa about the same time, actually. And they're there and they do their thing through many different phases of climate change until about 40,000 years ago, which is when they disappear. So there's this long span of their existence. And before we had the advent of ancient DNA as a science, it was not clear at all whether we even ever met Neanderthals, because what the archaeology seemed to suggest was that Neanderthals disappear and we turn up about the same time, but it wasn't certain, you know, was this real overlap or not? Whereas now the picture is showing, first off, Homo sapiens are into Eurasia way before 40,000 years ago. We do know that now, but also that there was interbreeding, as I said, early, so over 200,000 years ago, and then probably multiple times after about 60,000 years ago. And this may relate to different pulses of dispersal out of Africa by Homo sapiens. So different waves are coming out, encountering Neanderthals and other hominins in Eurasia, because there's other forms closely related, like the Denisovans, people might have heard of. But over time, those Homo sapiens groups seem actually to go extinct in Eurasia. And it's only the very later period where we've got the interbreeding. One of those populations that interbred with Neanderthals is what sort of kept that genetic legacy and is what we have in living people today. But there were many times before that. However, saying all that, that makes it sound like everyone is at it everywhere. It's not the case. What the impression we get is that when Neanderthals or other hominins met each other, that sex is one normal outcome of that, but that those meetings perhaps didn't happen very often, and certainly not often enough, and that there isn't, you know, hybridizing at a big enough scale that meant that the differences anatomically between us and Neanderthals would kind of blur. They always looked different and we always looked different to them. So they could never have been like, it wasn't like a Borg thing, you know, just a complete, you know, taking over and absorbing of Neanderthals. It's much more piecemeal and complex, although over time that could have had, you know, a large impact and be part of the reasons as to why they're not around. But yeah, like, okay, so sex happened. What does that actually mean? The answer is we don't know. You know, there are many different scenarios as to how someone ends up having sex with somebody else. It might be consensual. It might not be. I think we can assume both things, actually, because the time span and the geographic range over which this was going on was probably quite large. And you're going to be looking at different contexts for this everywhere that this is going on. And again, if we look at chimpanzees, chimpanzees specifically have been drawn on in thinking about relationships between different hominin species for a long time. And chimps are really quite famous for not liking strangers. They're extremely violent to different groups. You know, if they think the numbers are in their favor, they will try and attack and kill strangers. There's no evidence of sort of sexual violence that I know between chimpanzee groups, but they're quite keen on murder if they can get away with it. But bonobos, which are close relations of chimpanzees, sometimes called pygmy chimpanzees, their society is very different, and they are really quite open to friendly relations between different groups. They will hang out with each other and kind of, you know, just move through the forest for a little while. Individuals can move between groups much more easily. There's just a lot less, you know, bonobos are much less stressy about this whole thing. And we only have really begun understanding bonobos much more recently. So I think they are just as good a potential model for what's going on with Neanderthals and Homo sapiens as chimpanzees are.
Yeah.
And one other thing that, you know, bonobos are famous for is that they use sex as a means to de-stress in all sorts of situations. So, you know, perhaps we can maybe imagine in some situations that there is an amicable meeting of groups, people are curious, and it's all rather nice, you know, whereas in other situations, maybe not. But I think, yeah, in terms of like the plumbing side of it, their bodies, you know, their skeletons are really, really similar to ours on a gross anatomical scale. Like I said, you know, if you look in detail, there's differences all over their body. Some of them very small, some of them more obvious, like their faces are different, but they're humans. What we can't tell is, like, you know, relative size of tackle or whatever. But we do know that Neanderthals didn't have the gene for penis spines, which is this thing that some other primates have. They're kind of more like just like little nodule things. But apparently not having them make sex last longer. Therefore, it's probably more pleasurable. Okay. So, If it's all good and everyone's friendly and it's a nice kind of vibe, I think everybody had a good time.
Okay, well, I hope so. I think just there was a bloke, a human bloke who couldn't get a girlfriend, so he went and shagged a Neanderthal. That's my guess.
Oh, but yes, that's not fair though. Assuming that Neanderthal women are not attractive.
I think it would have been looked down on, in both directions. I'm not saying. You know, a Neanderthal to another Neanderthal obviously is attractive.
I don't know. There are some recent reconstructions that are quite attractive.
Yeah, it's, well, we do have the wrong idea, as the book says. I mean, there's loads we could talk about. Let's quickly discuss why there are no Neanderthals now, except the little bit of their DNA that survives within us. Is it down to social networking that because humans were better, Homo sapiens were better at kind of, you know, being a social animal and making networks and maybe Neanderthals were more in their little tribes and not mixing around too much?
Well, first I'm going to say, everybody always leaves this question to the end in interviews. Yeah. You say, just quickly, this is like the biggest question about Neanderthals, so there is no just quickly. But yeah, I mean, just like all of the aspects to do with how we study Neanderthals, as we've got more information and we've got all different methods of trying to tackle this question, the answers have become more complicated. And I think what we can say is that there is not one reason for this, why they're not around in physical form, although they are present in our bodies. I think most researchers would probably say it's not just climate. Although as you get to that last 10,000 years that they're about, between 50 to 40,000 years, it's getting colder and sort of the state of the climate is becoming less predictable. It's kind of zigzagging up and down in terms of temperature. So that's not going to help for sure. Mm-hmm. But they had survived colder periods before. They'd also survived some instability. So it can't just be that. On the other hand, there is genetic evidence that their population overall, their kind of their meta populations, had been shrinking over time. So something's going on which is leading to their populations overall to shrink, which is going to leave you in a more vulnerable position. What we can tell from genetics is also very interesting, in that when you look at individual Neanderthals, although not all of them are inbred and in a genetic sense of you know, showing a mating pool that's very small, a number of them that we've studied are, where, you know, the number of individuals who are available to mate with, it's like 100 or less. That's extinction level. That's like rhinos, you know, that's not good news. So for whatever reason, they are in very, some of them are in very isolated populations. And again, that can be bad in terms of sort of the accumulation of sort of unhelpful genetic mutations over time. But it's also just not good because it means that you haven't got the ability to bounce back if there is a larger crisis that happens. So there's that. But also the other thing that is sort of a novel event is, although I said earlier that we have a long history of Homo sapiens, longer history than we used to think, of Homo sapiens entering into Eurasia over 100,000 years ago and encountering Neanderthals and things, there is perhaps a culturally different and maybe cognitively different dispersal of Homo sapiens that happens after 60,000 years. And they may have brought with them different kinds of technology, in particular projectile weapons. So by that I mean very lightweight spears or darts and perhaps bow and arrow technology. And we don't think Neanderthals had that. So maybe that might have meant that hunting was just more successful. You know, you don't have to get close to really very large dangerous animals. You can shoot them from a distance. It's just safer. There's less risk. Maybe more successful. So there's that as well. But also the genetics of these early Homo sapiens people doesn't look like the Neanderthals in terms of their social connectedness. They don't look really isolated. They don't look inbred. Somehow, although there is probably just as few of them as there are of Neanderthals, they're able to remain connected to each other as a wider meta population. And, you know, you have a bigger choice of breeding partners. How they're doing that is a really interesting question. Are they able to schedule meetings? You know, like say, I'll see you next year at the next spring hunt. And Neanderthals don't do that. Maybe Neanderthals meet each other more by chance. They could still encounter each other seasonally, but yeah, by accident. So there's all these different elements that come together. But basically, I don't think it's just about the fact that I don't think we can argue that we were just cleverer than them. I think there is a lot of different things coming together at a particular point. And for whatever reason, Neanderthal populations presumably just keep shrinking and shrinking and shrinking and shrinking until they disappear, while other individual genetic lineages are absorbed into the Homo sapiens people of the time. Although we don't know if like entire groups are actually mixing. So that was a very not quick answer. Sorry.
It wasn't, but no, it's obviously a big question. And I suppose you are saying as well that the groups of Homo sapiens also died out. So you're talking about those particular groups that didn't lead to anywhere. So there's sort of obviously some chance in it, though, I suppose, in evolutionary terms over a long period of time, the sort of luck evens out and it becomes about a little bit more.
Yeah. And I think that's really important for how we think about this whole process. And you know, the lesson of the Neanderthals, if there is one, I think has also come from this new understanding that a lot of these early Homo sapiens populations just vanished. You know, like it wasn't like we just suddenly arrive in Eurasia and it's like, yo, we're here, we're staying, that's us, we're done. No, we suffered extinctions as well. You know, life was not easy. And yes, luck is a big part of it. And, you know, you can be really well adapted to a world and stuff, you know, can go dramatically wrong. And it's not because you were rubbish that you don't make it. Like, you know, I say this before, like the dinosaurs, was it their fault that they are not around apart from birds? Well, no, they had a really hard a hard time of it at the end, yeah. But they were very good before that. So,
sure. Well, look, it's a really fantastic book. I love, you know, the it's beautifully written, it's lyrically written, and there's some sort of imagined passages where you really bring to life what hopefully it might have been like for the Neanderthals. It's also got great technical stuff in it. When I say the archaeology is boring, I mean to do. It's very interesting to read about. It's absolutely fascinating. It's absolutely fascinating to read about. And, you know, it's just sort of incredible how much you've brought together and, you know, how much we've got wrong about the Neanderthals. You were telling me by email that the new, is it Graham Hancock? Is that his name? Has done the Netflix. The Netflix series, which involves Neanderthals, yeah.
Ancient Apocalypse. Yeah, I mean, yeah. He has all sorts of complete wild, unsupported claims that there was some massive ice age global civilization that taught all the stupid later Neolithic people how to farm and all this stuff, and he's just got no understanding at all of the records. And yeah, there's no anybody that's watched it. Let me tell you, nonsense.
Well, I'm imagining you worked a bit harder on your book than he did. Although it's quite hard to make things up. That's the thing. So it's harder to make things up than it is to see some evidence and work out what happened. So maybe Graham Hancock deserves some credit for his imagination.
Well, it'd be nice if he acknowledged it as fiction, but you know.
Well, it sells a lot of books, but this should sell. It's a really brilliant book. I hope people will buy it. I know it's been out for a couple of years, and obviously new things have happened as we've discussed since then. So it feels like in another 10 years' time you could write another book which will take us even further. I mean, do you think there's any chance of, you do talk about discovering a sort of a Neanderthal, you know, in the permafrost somewhere. I mean, is there any chance there might be a secret forest full of Neanderthals that we haven't discovered yet that might still be alive?
There's always a chance, you know. but no, I mean, there have been more recent finds of, you know, incredible things like wolves and even cave lion cubs, astonishingly preserved, you know, just the tiny little faces. So, yeah, I mean, it's possible. And I don't know how I'd feel emotionally about it. It would be quite strange.
What would you say to a Neanderthal if you could talk to a Neanderthal? What would be your first question you would ask a living Neanderthal?
Oh my God. I'd like to know how they just perceived other animals is a really intriguing question to me.
Right.
You know, we have a very odd, very westernized idea of animals as just as resources, but if you look at a lot of traditional indigenous cultures, they see them as other beings, other relations. So I'd be interested to know that about Neanderthals.
That's very good. Look, it's a really great book. Please do buy it, please do read it. Are there any books that you're reading at the moment or that you would like to recommend to our listeners?
Yes, I am reading a book right now, which is really awesome, by Jamie Green. And it's called The Possibility of Life, Searching for Kinship in the Cosmos. Mm. And this is coming out in April in the UK. And it's an amazing book. It's all about the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, actually, which has a lot of interesting overlaps with Neanderthal, sort of how we think about other beings. And it's about how we actually do that. But it's kind of got loads of really awesome stuff about like pop culture, you know, Star Trek, all this really cool stuff, Carl Sagan, loads of stuff like that. So I love that. So look out for that.
I will look out. That sounds up my street as well. Thank you very much for talking to us, Rebecca. There's so much more in the book than we could even begin to cover. So do buy the book and have a... I got the... You do your own audio book, which you do extremely well. Was that your choice to do it yourself? Was there any pullback on you doing it?
No, I really wanted to do it myself, but it was really difficult. I recorded it during June 2020 lockdown, right. And I had to... they sent a studio to my house, and I live in the countryside, so we had to edit out hundreds and hundreds of sort of occasions of tractors going past my window and lots of swearing and things. So
brilliant. Well, it's a great way to enjoy it and buy the book as well. I always do both, so you know, it's good to have the book in it, especially with something that's a bit more academic. It's good to be able to read it yourself as well as listen, but it is a manageable listen, even though there's some good detail in there. There's some good academic detail. Thank you very much for joining us, Rebecca. I'm not sure who's on next week, but It'll be fun, whoever it is. Thanks for listening.
Thank you so much.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love. And be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Thanks for listening. richardherring.com/gigs. GoFasterStripe.com for all my books, downloads, all that sort of shizzle. Oh, yeah, I know all the cool words. And would love to see you on the Can I Have My Ball Back tour if you can make it. Bye.